Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon. Welcome, everybody. How many people here for the first time? Yes, yes, yes. Welcome. Welcome to anybody joining us on Zoom for the first time tonight. I like to begin class by inviting you, asking you, encouraging you to talk to each other a little bit. One of the core, in service of one of the core tenets of Buddhism, is developing connection with other people on the path, what we call Sangha, community, having wise friends, having relationships with people who are also trying to wake up and suffering and have more wisdom in our lives. Meditation groups are the ideal place to meet other meditators, but also a fucking weird place to meet people because you're meditating and, you know, there's not a lot of, so I try to start with a little interaction. And towards the end of class last week, I forget the full context, but there was a question about relationships. There was a question about, you know, how do we ideally practice intimacy, sexuality, romance in the Dharma, where there's all this emphasis on non-attachment. And so how do we have love and non-attachment? How do we have sex and not cling? Is the topic tonight. We're going to talk about sex tonight, and I'll share some Buddhist perspectives. And so for your small groups, I'm going to ask you a stupid question for you to answer in your small groups. Maybe stupid, maybe not. And it assumes, so here's the question you can reflect on a little bit. What do you like about sex? Why do you like sex? And really kind of like checking in, like, why do I like sex? And, you know, and go beyond like, because it feels good. What, you know, what is it about sexual connection that you like? Now, I know that there's probably a minority of our community that is going to be like, I don't have sex. I'm asexual, or, you know, like my mom is here tonight. I'm pretty sure she hasn't had sex in sometime in the 1990s. Sorry, Mom. She's like, yeah, it's true. So, you know, so some of us, it's not completely applicable to all of us. But probably the majority of the Sangha, you know, and in Buddhism, there's two levels. Sangha is this word for community, and they talk about a fourfold Sangha in Buddhism. And that is the, and it's very binary gender-wise in traditional Buddhism, but it's the male monastics, the female monastics, the male householders and the female householders. And then, of course, we can expand that to also non-binary people included in there. But the 2,600-year formulation is very binary. And maybe this isn't, if you're brand new to Buddhism, it might not make sense, but if you've practiced Buddhism for a little while, I'd imagine, I mean, it's true for me, and a lot of people, there's a decision at some point where we say, I'm serious about Buddhism, I really like Buddhism, I want to do this, I want to learn this, I want to experience all the freedom that I can experience from meditation, and but I'm choosing to not join the monastic sangha. I'm choosing to not take a vow of celibacy. I want to do this in my householder life as a lay person. And so part of that question of, you know, what do you like about sex? Is what do you like so much about sex that you're choosing to continue down this path that, and I'll talk about it tonight, that includes suffering for all of us. right? Relationships that include suffering, rather than making that choice of like, you know, I really don't want to suffer. So maybe I should avoid things like intimate relationships that I always suffer in, like the monks and the nuns. Like, that's a viable, you know, so part of it is like, why the fuck are we doing this? What is it that we like so much about it that we're choosing to? And I'm going to talk about it in hopefully a more skillful way than that. But for you guys, to start with, what is it? Why do you keep having sex? What do you like about it so much? You know, what, and not just the pleasant sensation, but what else? So find a couple people, 2-3 people, small groups. And at home, I'll put you in breakout groups. Talk about sex. So now we'll meditate, and it'll have nothing to do with sex. Try not to think about sex while you're meditating. Or don't, it's okay, either way. But find a way to sit that's upright, relaxed. Find a posture that feels suitable, sustainable, where the body can relax around the upright spine. Allowing your eyes to be closed and take a moment to adjust and release, soften tension in the face, jaw, shoulders, throat, belly. Allowing our hands to rest on our legs and our lap, whatever feels comfortable. And then trying to sustain this posture, stillness, upright, sitting, meditation posture. Practicing mindfulness, the present time, investigative, kind awareness, bringing the attention inward to our bodies, mindfulness works best if we can bring an attitude of friendliness and kindness, acceptance, rather than trying to make our meditation be a certain way, just accepting our body as it is. Our minds, our hearts. Trying to meet all of it with an unconditional, friendly, accepting attitude. It's useful for the first few minutes of meditation to focus the attention on the breath, breathing in with mindfulness, breathing out, directing our attention away from the thoughts, away from the future and past, into the present time experience of sitting, breathing, feeling. Feel the breath as it comes and goes. Try your best to ignore your mind. Let the thoughts be in the background. Bringing our awareness back to the breath each time we find ourselves off in a plan or a memory or a fantasy, thinking about something, just disengaging, seeing for yourself that you can choose to redirect your attention back to the breath, feeling a breath or two, or three or four, concentrating, connecting, sustaining the awareness in the body, trying to let the thoughts be in the background. When you become involved in a thought, just naming it, thinking, planning, remembering, craving, resenting, worrying, whatever the mind's up to. when we're new to practice, using the breath, the body, disengaging from the thinking mind is foundational. Breaking our addiction to our minds. But the Buddha's encouragement is to become more and more inclusive, investigating what's happening moment to moment at all of the sense doors, including the mind, the heart, and trying to identify the feeling tone of our experience, our perception of pleasant sound, smell, taste, thought, feeling, sensation, or unpleasant, or neutral, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So much of our suffering is created by craving for pleasure, aversion to pain. In meditation, we are trying to see more clearly our relationship to pleasure and pain, neutrality, and to develop a wise response, learning to be uncomfortable without pushing it away. Learning to experience and enjoy pleasant phenomena without clinging to it. more we pay attention to the body, to the mind, to the phenomena of sound, smell, taste, the more we understand the truth of impermanence, the arising and passing, changing nature of how thoughts unfold, the breath comes and goes, sensations passing through awareness. Learning to be more accepting and tolerant of the unpleasant, uncomfortable, learning to be less attached to the impermanent pleasant thoughts, feelings, sensations. spending the last few minutes shifting from mindfulness to loving kindness meditation, saying to yourself, first, beginning with yourself, may I be at ease. May I learn to be at ease just as I am, with my mind, with my body. Reflecting on the topic of sex and relationships and intimacy, including this in your metta. I learned to be at ease with my sexuality, with my sensuality, with my desires. I learn to be at ease in my body, with just as it is. In our relationships. May I be at ease with intimacy or the lack of intimacy. Also with the solitude, when there isn't a connection. May we learn to be at ease with ourselves alone or together. Extending this wish to the people that you were sitting next to, that you perhaps were in the groups with, breakout rooms on Zoom, or extending this wish to the whole gathering, the Sangha community, just as I wish to experience ease and well-being. I also wish that for you. May you do what needs to be done in your life. To free yourself from any unnecessary suffering, may you learn to be at ease with yourself just as you are. With the pleasure and pain of existence. Extending this unconditional friendliness, goodwill, wish for ease and well-being outward, to all living beings, your friends, your family. To the unknown masses of humanity. Extending kindness in all directions, but also with this understanding that our wishes don't transform people. Everybody has to do that themselves. And so this phrase of may all beings do what needs to be done to experience the ease, the well-being, the happiness, the freedom that they seek. Encouraging attitude. Kind wishes. I want to start by acknowledging that I don't think I'm I don't think I'm really good at talking about sex. I don't think I think it's a very complex, complicated topic. There's part of me that would rather avoid talking about it in a Buddhist context because it's hard to talk about in generalizations to a community of people when we have so many different experiences and come from different orientations and but it's such a central part of being human, such a natural and central and part of being human. I feel like it's a disservice to avoid the topic, even though it's hard to talk about. It's hard, a bit hard for me to talk about. And, you know, I probably once a year, you know, give a talk on sex. And always have, you know, brought, you know, made it, you know, kind of in the series of it's a topic, but I don't, not a lot, but occasionally I try to address it with, you know, have the conversation, share some of the Buddha's teachings, some of my perspectives. And over, people, even people who've practiced Buddhism for a long time and been part of other sanghas and listened to lots of teachers, and been like, that's the first time I ever heard a Buddhist teacher really talk about sex. And you could study with some teachers for decades, and they never really talk about sex. And I think it does us a disservice because it's so central to our lives. Most of us. So maybe there's a handful of people who are like, it's not a big, you know, central thing for me. Or, and I'm saying sex, but it's intimacy, it's sensuality, it's connection and companionship, it's relationships, it's, you know, yes, some of the topic is sexual desire and intimate sensuality. Some of it's, you know, the part of the sexual masturbation and kind of sexual desire, self-satisfying sexual desire. It's such a powerful energy. So part of the frame is the Buddha's teachings are the cause, you know, first noble truth, there is suffering. Now in suffering, the Buddha talks of two things that I think often apply to our sexual, our relational, as he says, it is suffering to be separated from that which you are attached to, that which you want to keep. And so, you know, the truth of impermanence, and then in relationships, often, I mean, probably all of us have had some level of suffering about a relationship ending. So the one that we weren't ready for it to end, or maybe it didn't end quickly enough or whatever it was, but that kind of tendency towards suffering around loss and impermanence in relationships. Or he said the other piece is, experiencing unpleasant things that you don't want to experience. And probably, maybe not every single one of us, but most of us have probably experienced some suffering around unwanted sexual experience or attention or objectification or coercion or rape or molestation or some traumatic sexual experiences, incredibly common. Yeah. And often we don't talk about it in this sort of forum, but incredibly common to have some suffering around sexuality. And the second noble truth, it says, the cause of human suffering is repetitive craving and clinging to pleasure. Primarily to sense pleasures. And the way that we're biologically have evolved, and it seems like probably for all species, not just us humans, but that sex has to be really pleasant. And hopefully your sex is pleasant. I know that's not always true, but ideally, it's pleasant. And then, of course, we crave for pleasure and we get attached to pleasure. And, you know, the second noble truth, the cause of our suffering, craving for pleasure, clinging to pleasure. And for most people, I think probably healthy, ideal, good sex, whatever that is for you, is probably the most pleasant thing most humans experience. You know, we're in a room where a lot of us are recovering drug addicts, and then all of us will be like, you know what, heroin feels much better than orgasm. I mean, orgasm is pretty good, but not quite as good as opiates. When we're talking about pleasure. Or crack or cocaine or, you know, whatever your drug of choice. Maybe some of you even like drinking better than fucking. Maybe. It's sort of a powerful central energy. And that question that I asked you in the beginning of like, why do you like it? Do you, I mean, maybe I should have said, do you like sex? Why do you like sex? What is it about sex that you like? And not just orgasm sex, but the flirting sexuality, intrigue, connection. And really, like, if we look at our relationships, what do you like better? You know, and there's this kind of phenomena of sex addiction and of love addiction and of people who get completely strung out on intrigue, aren't even so interested in the sex or the intimacy or the actual companion connection relationship of a intimate relationship, but just that addiction to novelty and intrigue and chasing and lusting and that. So it's so fucking exciting. Like many of us drug addicts also remembered that, like, it's almost that feeling of like trying to cop, of like trying to get drugs. And it's like, so like, and then once you got it, it was just kind of like, okay, finally I got it. But it was almost as good, the seeking, the craving, the intrigue around, am I going to get it? Am I going to score? And, you know, that's part of sexual dynamic too, that intrigue that happens. And then the dynamic of being in long-term, you know, if you are, you know, whether you're monogamous or not monogamous, but being in long-term relationships, most of the Buddha's teachings do refer to sort of assume monogamy on some level. But, you know, of course, we live in this modern society with all of the folks talking about poly and polyamory and ethical non-monogamy. And the Buddha didn't seem to have any judgment of it. And many of his students were royalty with, like, you know, and the Buddha himself talked about being involved in orgies. You know, that was just sort of like, when you're part of royalty, it's just sort of what happens. There's like group sex, especially when you're he was a prince and his father was the king. And he talks about at one point waking up after an orgy and everybody was like passed out naked and and these people that were so beautiful when they were awake were like, you know, snoring and farting and drooling. And it was part of his sort of like disenchantment with sensuality and with sexuality, where he was like, this is like, you know, they were so sexy when they were dancing and when we were fucking or whatever it was, but now they're just like snoring and drooling and kind of gross. And reflecting on, you know, our own experience of our relationship to desire and to intrigue and to being in relationships and receiving intimacy, like really being seen and really seeing and really being present for another person. And you know, tolerating moods and attitudes and conflict. I feel like conflict in relationships is common. It's sort of a given. There's going to be, you know, times where we don't want the same thing at the same time. And, you know, that I said the other night, some meme I saw that was like, you know, relationship is, you know, asking your partner every single day, so what do you want for dinner? And that negotiation of like, no, I don't know. What do you want? I don't know. What do you want? I don't know. What do you want? All of the communication and that high level of communication, empathizing with another person's emotions and moods. And and that long-term companionship and connection. And and how's that? Like, how much do you like that? And how attached are you to that sort of false sense of security? We can just call it a sense of, you know, security. Hopefully there's some level of security, but in this world of impermanence and change, and you know that, you know, there is some wisdom in seeing that even the most secure connection is it's still subject to impermanence, it's still subject to perhaps, you know, change. And such a powerful part of our being. And I feel like there's a dilemma I've for a long time felt like there's a dilemma of being a Buddhist, being so inspired by the teachings of the Buddha, being so interested and committed to following the Buddha's teachings and to doing what I can to end suffering in my life, following the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the Five Precepts and meditating and going on retreats and being of service and like really taking this path seriously, but not so seriously that take a vow of celibacy and become a monk. And that dilemma of this teacher, you know, we've got the painting, you know, we have the images, this teacher, Siddhartha Gautama, who discovered mindfulness, who taught, you know, and inspired and showed us like it's possible to develop wisdom. It's possible to develop compassion. It's possible to change your relationship to pleasure and pain and to the mind and change your, you know, relationship to the self. And he chose, his enlightenment led to a choice of non-sexuality, of celibacy. And that kind of like, well, I want to be a real serious Buddhist, but also I want to be in relationship. And that question of like, why? Like, oh, I really like sensation. I really like attention. I really like companionship. I really like connection. I really like, I'm attached to sensual, sexual relationship, or I would have become a monk. But it's been, there was a shift that happened for me, I think probably when I started practicing. I hadn't even really thought about celibacy, or just was, you know, horny ever since I was a teenager and just want to have sex. But at some point, I think in my 20s, when I was practicing a lot of retreats and studying Buddhism and realizing like, oh, the Buddha is celibate, and I have these teachers who are celibate, and starting to realize sex is a choice. It's not just like you're horny, so you have to have sex. It's not just like, well, it's natural, and of course I have a crush on this person, and I like want to. I hadn't even really, but that important thing on the path of questioning it. And I don't know if this is making sense. Like, do you see it as a choice? Like that absolutely celibacy is a viable option. And although we live in such a sensual material world, it's not that common, unless you're kind of a monastic, to not be sexually seeking or engaged in wanting it or participating on some level, even masturbation, right? But I encourage all of us to reflect and to think about, it's 100% a choice. And celibacy is a totally viable option. You never have to have sex again, unless you want to. Or even if you want to, you still don't ever have to have sex again. I'm going to go in a couple weeks and be on retreat with one of my teachers, who's a Buddhist monk who I think he's must be close to 50 years in robes now, maybe 40. He's in 40 something. And, you know, so 40 something years ago, I don't know exactly, but I think it's like getting close to 50 years. And 40 something years ago, he made the decision. He said, I want to take Buddhism really seriously. I'm so inspired. I want to get enlightened as much as I can in this lifetime. And I'm going to join this monastic order. And I'm not going to masturbate ever again. I'm not going to have sex ever again. You know, one day at a time. But, you know, here he is. Here he is, you know, 40 something years into it. And he'll talk about like, oh, yeah, you know, sexual desire doesn't go away just because you don't satisfy it. Your relationship to it changes. It's part of having a human mind and body and nervous system and, you know, biological, evolutionary, procreational, you know, kind of thing that we all have on one level or another. But this monk and the monks, they seem so happy, so joyous, so unburdened by a lot of things, but particularly sex and relationships and intimacy. So I know it was a big shift for me, and I encourage you to look at this if you haven't already, you know, deeply kind of investigated. And I am choosing this. In my 20s, I spent 2 years celibate because I was inspired by the monks, and I had another teacher who was encouraging celibacy. And so I spent 2 years, and I was like, okay, I won't masturbate for 30 days. And I was like 22. And I was so horny all the time, early 20s. And I was like, okay, I'll stop masturbating for 30 days. And then somewhere in there, it kind of became 90 days. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to stop. I'm not in a relationship, and I'm not going to seek a relationship. I'm going to be totally celibate, and I'm going to see how this goes. And it just kept going for like just under 2 years. And I learned so much about desire by not satisfying it and seeing the impermanent nature of desire and seeing that it wasn't just orgasm, it was attention, and it was, you know, that I was seeking. And I'm sure I was still seeking attention. I was also doing a lot of graffiti in those days. Celibate, vegan, graffiti, thug at the time. Still seeking attention. Just not copulating. And I went to the monastery. After that, I broke my celibacy, and I was in a relationship for a while. And then I went off to Asia the first time, and I was probably about 25 years old or something like that. And I was 7 years sober, and I went to the monastery, and I thought, like, maybe I'll go become a monk. And when I got to Thailand, and then I went to Burma, and then I went to Sri Lanka, and then I went to Nepal, and then I was on this sort of pilgrimage. But when I got to the monastery and I thought, oh, maybe I'll become a monk, I just had this feeling of like resistance and like it just wasn't the right thing for me. I felt like I'm so committed to the Buddhist path. I want to be really committed to the Buddhist path. But I feel like there's some healing that I'll miss if I just avoid sexuality. I think some of that came from some of my other teachers and my father, and who were Buddhist practitioners, but were in relationships and I just feel like I've got some wounds around sex, for sure. I've got some wounds around my masculinity and around intimacy and... and I feel like part of my path in this life is a healing path, a path of recovery, a path of healing, a path of learning to be wise with sexuality, learning to be in relationships, learning, and this really high, because the ideal, right, there's non-attachment and celibacy in the form of not participating. And then there's the, okay, I'm choosing to participate. I'm not going to be celibate. I'm choosing the joy and sorrow of sensuality, of relationships. And I'm committed to non-attachment, but I can't do it in relationships. How, you know, and that, you know, has anybody been successful? And so I realized that the ideal, and that my experience, and I think that probably most of us unenlightened, you know, beings, is that there's in, with practice, there's those moments, maybe even without practice, there's those moments in sexual, intimate, connected relationships of connection, where, and just that, you know, good, healthy, mutual connection. But that inevitably, one of us starts to cling, to get attached. And then from that clinging, my tendency, I don't know about yours, but my tendency is to then kind of overcompensate and detach. And then come back together. And then cling, and then detach, and then connect, and then cling, and then detach, and then connect, and then cling again. And it's kind of a dance, rather than the idea, which is like perfect, connected, non-attached, loving presence, right? That's the ideal. Like, can you do that? There's a teaching, I don't know exactly where it is in the suttas, but the Buddha said, you know, when asked about celibacy and this choice to avoid sex, he said, the sexual energy and the craving and the clinging of human conditioning, he says, we can navigate our sexual energy with mindfulness, with intentionality, with some renunciation with, he said, but it's the most powerful energy that humans, it causes more suffering for humans than anything else. It's the most powerful. And he said, if there was another energy in the human experience that was as powerful as sex drive, sexuality, desire, he said, then I don't think enlightenment would even be possible. Like, it's possible for us if we really change our relationship to pleasure and the craving and clinging tendency that we have towards pleasure. And but part of the connotation of that, which blows my mind a little bit, is that he's saying that actually lust and clinging and is more powerful than hatred. There's more suffering on this planet right now about sexual relationships than there is about hatred and violence and war. You know, and we look at the news and we're like, what the fuck is happening in Palestine? What the fuck is happening in the Congo, in the Ukraine, in our neighborhoods with sexism and racism and, you know, all of the ignorance that's happening? And it all looks like violence. Right, the news is all about violence, war, and there's so much of that happening on this planet. But there, like, there's all of, like, all of us here we are as a microcosm of Western privilege, not in a war zone, middle class, upper middle class, working class, wherever we are in that kind of socioeconomic spectrum, none of us are suffering about war and violence right now, but probably all of us could find some suffering about our sexual relationships right now. Probably, if you look for it, you can, you know, if you wanted to get honest, you'd probably find some dukkha that's not about violence, but that's about intimacy, that's about sensuality, that's about sex. And when you look at the world, there's all kinds of terrible, terrible things happening in this world. And then there's all of these places in the world where there's nothing terrible, terrible happening, maybe. But everyone has some suffering about sex. Everyone in their life has some dukkha, first noble truth, about sexual relationships, intimacy, whether it's the, you know, the conflicts that arise in relationship or the impermanence, the loved ones dying, people being dishonest, unethical, you know, rampant cheating that happens in relationships, the betrayals. It's fun to talk about sex, huh? Super cheery about it. So then there's this mythological practice of Tantra, Buddhist tantric sexuality. Now, that sort of ideal of being connected without clinging is Tantra, I think. That can I be in sexual and intimate and connection, engaging in it, right? Not celibacy, not avoidance of, but engaging in pleasurable activities like sensual relationships. Without clinging. That's the sort of definition of Tantra. And, you know, in not so much in the Theravadan tradition, but in the Mahayana and the Vajrayana, you'll see like in the Tibetan Buddhists, where they're, you know, like even statues where they're like fucking, Buddha's fucking. These Buddha statues, and there's this beautiful, you know, it's always this heteronormative thing, but there's this, you know, male Buddha sitting in this female deity, you know, sitting on his lap, and they're fucking yab yum. One time the Dalai Lama was asked about Tibetan Buddhist Tantra. And he said, well, you know, yes, it's in the teachings and it's in our, you know, it's in our tradition. He said, but I don't know anybody alive that could have sex without clinging. He said, and I know all the highest Rinpoches and Lamas. And he's like, I'm the fucking Dalai Lama. And I couldn't do it. And I don't know any of them that could do it. I'm not convinced that any of these guys that are fucking their students could do it without clinging. And he used this analogy. He said, in order to get to that level of non-preference for pleasure, to call it Tantra, that non-clinging, he said, you'd have to develop the kind of, he used the term equanimity, but you'd have to develop the level of equanimity where you no longer had any preference over eating chocolate cake or dog shit. And when you can eat dog shit, you can call your fucking Tantra. Like true enlightened non-preference for pleasure over disgust. Then you can, right? You, then when you're really that non-attached, where you're just like, yeah, whatever, chocolate cake, it's pretty good. Dog shit, not that bad. The Dalai Lama doesn't think it's possible to have that level of enlightened. And then in the Theravadan tradition, they say, if you get that enlightened, you don't want to have sex anymore. Which I always, I'm like, fuck, really? I was hoping that I could get all the way enlightened and still want to have sex. But they're like, no, it just like falls away. The desire for that friction falls away when you're, you know, some level of liberation. You just don't really want it anymore. So some conversation with you, any questions or comments, you know, just to kind of come back to sex is a choice. We're all going to have some suffering in it. Ideally, we're going to try to bring as much loving presence and non-attachment to it. Honesty, integrity. You know, in the fifth precept, when the Buddha talks, you know, one of the only places where sex is really addressed, he says, avoid sexual misconduct. And, it, you know, in this way, Buddhism is quite liberal. And the Buddha was quite liberal. He's like consenting adults that aren't cheating on each other. Consenting, you know, like it's not totally heteronormative. There's none of that stuff in the original teachings. It just says consensual adults. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't sleep with people you shouldn't be sleeping with because they're in a relationship or you're in a relationship, you're breaking your vows or theirs. There's also a thing about not sleeping with prisoners or human, you know, and so I think it's about sort of sex slaves, you know, in the ancient times where they turned the female prisons into brothels. And he's like, yeah, don't go do that. Don't, you know, it's not consensual, you know. So it's really, you know, the big thing is around consent. And consent takes a lot of communication. And there's, you know, lots of levels of communication for consent, and not to be assumed and not to be, you know, taken lightly, you know, real communication. And yeah, you know, and it, you know, as far as the like cheating thing, it's based on what information that you have. And, you know, if somebody tells you that they're not married when they are married, you know, your karma is around your intention. If you didn't know, you know, but if you did know, then there's, you know, some suffering that you're participating in there. So what are your thoughts, questions, comments about, please, Eric.
So the Buddhist teaches that there is a way out of suffering. And my question is it necessary, is it a requirement to be celibate, to gain enlightenment, and to free yourself from suffering? And then what about procreation? Does he talk about that?
So the simple answer is, the answer is no, it's not necessary to be celibate. There's in the teachings, there's lots of examples of liberated householders like you and me, and lots of women, you know, lots of women, lots of men who get liberated that aren't monastics. And so the answer is no, you don't have to be. My sense is that it's going to be easier to get enlightened if you're not engaged in these sort of pleasure-producing attachment tendencies, right? We're trying to free ourselves from attachment. So probably liberation on a celibate path is probably easier than liberation on a householder path. And so we're choosing to make our liberation more difficult. On some level, we think like, no way, like this is way easier. I get to cuddle. I get to, you know, have sex. I get intimacy. I get connection. I don't have to be, you know, living with a bunch of bald dudes in dresses at the monastery. But probably for our liberation, we're choosing a more difficult path than celibacy. Would probably be easier for our liberation. What was the last part of it? Oh, procreation. Well, so few people are going to choose celibacy that that's just not an issue. Sure. The masses are going to keep fucking. So it's not, you know, and Buddha, you know, and the Buddha, you know, he said only a handful of people in every generation will probably really follow this thing, householders or monastics. So there's not really a big danger, even in countries where monasticism is normalized, like Thailand. You know, it's a very small percentage of the population that choose that monastic path. So it's not, there's no worry about population. Yeah. Yeah. Megan, go ahead.
Hi, thanks. So everything that I'm hearing in the suttas and what you're explaining seems to me a lot focused on like the individual, just me, myself, and my karma, and what can I do to become liberated. And I kind of wonder what the Buddha felt or what he preached about, you know, human connection, because as we know, sexuality is a form of human connection. And like in a monastic community, they work as a team to further their goals or whatever. And by like the celibacy vow, you know, it seems like you're taking a central part of the human experience and connection and taking that out of the mix, which I see like the connection to suffering. But like, why does the Buddha feel that, you know, that you can't enjoy that aspect of connection and the human experience and still be like liberated? Like, I guess I kind of don't understand. It seems kind of self-centric, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And I think there's a lot of truth to what you're saying, that the Buddha's main mission, it seemed like, was to give to share his experience as a person of how he freed himself from suffering, and to share this and, you know, to create this path with other people and say, if you want to free yourself from suffering, here's how you can do it. And, you know, you're going to have to change your relationship to pleasure and pain in sexual relationships, whether you choose the celibate path or the householder non-celibate path. There's still going to have to be a shift. You can't just continue to be unconsciously driven by your sex desire. You have to bring it all into awareness, into consciousness, and to relate to it, to avoid misconduct, and to have ethics and integrity around it. And you're absolutely right. Like, you know, the connection, the nuns and the monks, they live together. And even though they're celibate, they're very connected. There's very, you know, it's really a communal thing, and it's very intimate, and they're living together, and they're, you know, I'm sure that there's a lot of love that gets developed, a lot of companionship, and it's just, you know, they're just removing the physical act, but they're probably falling in love with each other in a, you know, more of a metta, universal love kind of way than a romantic. They are avoiding romance. And like I said to Eric in his question, it is taught that it is possible to become liberated without taking a vow of celibacy. But the Buddha as the model and the monastic, you know, system as the model, it does seem like there's a sort of, it's a bit easier if you really want to get free to avoid sex. And then for those of us who kind of say like, well, you know, I'm okay with being on a slower path or, you know, making it a little bit more difficult on myself, I'll take the karma and the extra added difficulties. I'm signing up for that. Not feeling like a victim, not feeling like I'm stuck, but feeling like it's a conscious choice. Hope that was helpful. Anything else? Time for one more, maybe. Ryan.
Yeah, thanks. Great talk. When we were in our small group, we were just like really baffled by the, like, what about this is so worth suffering about? Like, what about this? Like, I know it's so distracting, right? I mean, at least in my own practice, like, the sexual energy that is in me is like very, it's just hard to focus. It makes it hard for at least me. But like, what about it makes me like put it on the worth it scale and be like, yep, yeah, worth it. Worth it, like completely, like, because like enlightenment and, you know, awakening is so beautiful and fulfilling in my experience. This path is so fulfilling and is freeing and incredible. And but then it's like, I remember going, leaving retreat and going back to like just crazy sexual energy and just being like, oh, you know, beautiful for like, fuck, you know, like what? What about, is it in the survival instinct? Is it like, I don't know. It's just interesting to me.
It's a good question. I've reflected on that one a lot in my life. And I said it a little bit, but what I came to was that I feel like it's part of the healing to be intimate. It's part of the recovery for me and awakening to do it in the world, in sensual, sexual, committed, for me, monogamous relationships. So it's part of my practice, not a distraction from the practice. I'm pretty good at being happy alone. And I've spent periods of my life celibate. And I feel like I'm missing, you know, like I have a tendency to maybe want to avoid intimacy. And so in relationships, I get to not avoid intimacy and be mindful and practicing and present with something that it can be uncomfortable. And so it feels like it's part of the path to awakening rather than be a little bit easier to avoid intimacy for some of us. Maybe we'll leave it there for tonight. Thank you for your reflections. Again, as I started, like, I don't have the definitive perspectives on this stuff. I apologize to anybody I might have offended with, you know, any of my perspectives or flippancy around some of this. And of course, I didn't address all of it, but just some of the conversation around sex. Upcoming opportunities to practice with Against the Stream. We just finished our weekend, our spring weekend retreat in Echo Park, this urban retreat we did. A bunch of you were there. It was really cool. We were did, you know, this residential silent meditation in the middle of Los Angeles on the east side. It was right across the street from the lake. We were doing walking meditation around the lake, engaging in the city with our practice, with our mindfulness, with our loving kindness. We're going to do a 9-night retreat there in the fall, September 24th through October 3rd, something like that. It's open for registration now. I can only take about 20, 24 people at this place. It's small. There's a limited number of rooms. So if you're planning, you know, and the fall is coming, you know, I know it's not summer yet, but if you're going to take that, you know, week off of work and come sit for the 10 days, 9 nights retreat, register soon so that you know that you have your spot there, because it will fill up. And that's what happened this time. It always happens. People wait till the last minute and be like, I want to go to that retreat. And like, it's full. You got to plan. You got to get in early and reserve your spot. And then in November, I'm taking a group from Refuge Recovery, which is, you know, everyone's welcome, even if, but it's a refuge recovery based program that I'm leading to India, where we're going to go to Bodh Gaya, the place where the Buddha was enlightened. We're going to do Buddhist pilgrimage spots through India. We're going to go up to Nepal, to Lumbini, the place where the Buddha was born. We're going to go to Saranath, where the first teachings were given, to Rajgir, where the Buddha died. So we're going to go to all of these different places, Buddhist pilgrimage sites. And there's about 10 spots left in that pilgrimage. If you want to come, please join us. Lastly, I am available for counseling, guidance, support in your Dharma practice. I have a master's degree in psychology. I'm not a licensed psychotherapist. I never got licensed when I finished school 20 years ago. So I'm not really a psychotherapist. It's more like counseling, but it's, I'm well-trained in psychology. But mostly I like to bring my Buddhist perspective to the conversation. And so I'm very interested in working with people who are also interested in bringing the Buddhist perspective to mental health, to relationships, to life. So if anybody's interested in meeting with me, I have an office here where you can meet in person, or I can meet with people on Zoom. And I'm opening my books for new clients. I haven't for a while. Last year, I fired some of my clients because I was trying to focus on writing. But I'm not. Anyways, I'm opening the books again. So anybody that would like to meet with me, just come see me. I'll give you my number. Or you can just send an email to Against the Stream, info@againstthestream, and it comes to me. So I can schedule with you that way as well. Class is done by donation. Against the Stream's running at a little bit of a deficit, like maybe $2,000 or $3,000 a month under our costs are we bringing in. Our rent's $3,500 a month. We have employees, both Sebastian and myself, insurance, all of the expenses of the building. Be as generous as you can be. I've been doing this Monday night class for 19 years now. I've never charged people. I've never wanted to turn anybody away. It was easier. This class used to be a lot bigger. There was, when there was 100 people in the room, it was easier. But, we get 50 people on Zoom and 30 to 50 people in the room. And if everybody kicks in $10, $20, it adds up. Or if you become a monthly supporter and say, I want to give $50 or $100 or a month Against the Stream, it's really helpful and needed in order to really support the organization. So, and support me as a teacher. And so, make this continue to be available. So be as generous as you can be when it comes to donating. I think I'll leave it there for tonight. May any goodness that comes from our practice be shared with each other. And then outward, in all directions, shared with all sentient beings. May each one of us get as free as possible in this lifetime. And together, may we create a positive change on this planet. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for tuning into the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.